It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strangechamps. You know the Apple origin story, with the two Steves in the garage? You know the Facebook origin story with Mark Zuckerberg in his dorm. But if you want to tell the internet origin story, you have to talk about women.
It's hard to imagine now, but the very early internet had no browsers.
Claire Evans is the author of Broadband, the untold story of the women who made the internet.
The people who created the yellow pages, if you will, of the early internet, it was a bunch of women working in this office called the Network Information Center, or the NIC, at Stanford. They basically were the Google of their day. The head of this office was a woman named Elizabeth Feinler. And she was the person who answered the phone if you called the internet.
Hello, you've reached the internet.
Hi, I need to code in Pascal.
I have an article for that.
If you had a question, honestly, if you had a question about where some, you know, piece of software was running or who was in charge of some location.
Hello, this is the internet.
If you wanted to add your computer to the early internet and you wanted to know what protocols you needed to have, any question.
Yeah, I need to know the creator of Dungeons and Dragons, please.
There's a website that can answer that for you.
You would call this office and this woman would answer the phone and she was the one.
But my God, you're saying that the internet basically was a woman originally.
Hello, it's the internet.
I need directions to Poughkeepsie, New York.
I'll connect it to a map.
I mean, yes, I want to make a t-shirt that says the internet was a woman. Yeah, totally. I mean, she was the central sort of information nerve center of the internet for 20 years.
Okay, maybe it didn't work exactly like that, but if you use a computer today, thank a woman.
Hello, internet.
She was eventually the person who came up with the idea of separating the internet into domains. She came up with .com, .edu, .gov.
What about the other one? The one who's known as the mother of the internet, Radia Perlman?
Yeah, she was fundamental to the evolution of a technology called Ethernet. She is a network protocol routing designer.
She's also funny, and there's this famous verse, right? She adapted her spanning tree algorithm to that famous poem, yeah, I think I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree.
I think that I shall never see a graph more lovely than a tree. A tree whose crucial property is loop-free connectivity.
Yeah, so beautiful. Yeah, she wrote this iconic algorithm. I mean, it's still sort of the golden rule in network design circles that allows packets of information to travel across an Ethernet network without colliding into each other. And she wrote it in this moment of inspiration in just an afternoon. And then she had the rest of the weekend to kill before she had to go back to work on the Monday to write a beautiful algorithm. And then to follow it up with a beautiful poem about your algorithm is just, it's the kind of thing I want to see more of in tech.
You know what we'd like to see more of in tech? Women. But there's a saying, if you can't see it, you can't be it. And that is why telling the story of the women who made the internet matters. Claire Evans.
I think it's important to remember, I think most people don't realize this, that women didn't really come online in any significant numbers really until the World Wide Web took off in the mid-90s. So from the birth of the internet, from this network information center with a group of women answering the phones to the mid-1990s, women represented something like 10 or 15% of the online population. So if you were a woman on a really early online service, like a bulletin board service or a listserv or something, you were an oddity. And that usually came with a lot of undesired attention and harassment. And a lot of women used male aliases or gender-neutral pronouns when they used those services to avoid all of that. And so it made it kind of genuinely difficult for women to find each other on the early internet. It was complicated further by the fact that a lot of men would take on female aliases to talk to women online. So it was kind of a morass. So Stacey Horn, who was this, you know, she was a former telecommunications employee. She worked for Mobil Oil. She really wanted to create her own social space online in 1989. And so she started her own social network, a really early social network, a bulletin board system, or a BBS in New York. And again, this is a time at which women represent this tiny percentage of the online population, but her service had parity or close to it. Her users were 40% female.
How did she get such high numbers?
Because she was the only person trying, frankly. She made the efforts that none of her contemporaries, I think, made. She pounded the pavement in New York. She went to art galleries and concerts, really anywhere she thought somebody interesting might be hanging out. And she tried to convince people, mostly non-technical people, that they should do this crazy newfangled thing, which they called computer-mediated communication in those days. The early net was mostly crowded with programmers and engineers and early adopters, but she wanted artists and writers and the kind of people that you meet in New York City.
She had a catchphrase I love. The highest percentage of women in cyberspace, and none of them will give you the time of day.
Yeah, isn't that the best? Yeah. But I think it's really, you know, I often come back to her because I think this kind of outreach of just reaching beyond the expected user base and looking for people who might be interested in your service but might not know about it because they're not hard-nosed technical early adopter types, and then making it as easy as possible for them. So she taught courses out of her apartment on how to use the service. She made access free for women for a year. Mm-hmm. She would give areas of the service over to different women's groups. She made an area of the service women only, so women could sign on and talk to just each other amongst themselves the way that women do when we are talking amongst ourselves. But the most important thing, I think, is that she made sure that for every male moderator, or host they called in those days, there was a female moderator.
Wow.
Which meant that, you know, it's a simple gesture, but it meant that anytime a woman signed on, usually most likely for the very first time in her life, she would see herself reflected in, you know, the power structure of this place and the culture of this place. And that made it so that women felt more comfortable just jumping into conversation. They weren't lurkers. They were part of the culture. And that made the service, the platform, more interesting for everybody. It made it more dynamic. It made it more alive. It made it so that people were talking frankly about their lives instead of just listening to people who were most willing to jump on a soapbox and talk.
It's just such a poignant story because today many of us, I'm just listening to you and thinking, well, I wish the internet was like that today. I mean, it's a horrible space for women.
I think about this a lot. I mean, if Stacey had had the money to make the jump to the World Wide Web when the World Wide Web came along, or even just if the architects of our present day social networks had just made the same kinds of efforts at outreach and inclusion, these were sort of no nonsense efforts that Stacey made because she just knew that it was the right thing to do. What would our social networks look like today? I mean, what if those values were part and parcel of the way that we built things instead of being tacked on as an afterthought, you know, once the damage has already been done? That's really the value of looking at this history, is seeing the kinds of sort of simple strategies that are just waiting there for us to reclaim and readapt to our time. And sometimes those strategies are as simple as just making sure that there's a woman moderator in the same room as the male moderator. I mean, it's not a big thing, but the modern day equivalent could be really powerful.
Does uncovering this history make you angry? Because it makes me kind of angry thinking about, well, for instance, what it's like to be a woman online today. Mm-hmm. So many women encounter just blatant misogyny. And yet this is a space that could have been, should have been ours as much as anybody else's. So how did we go so wrong?
Certainly. I mean, yes, I get angry about it. I also try to be hopeful. I think that there's value in digging up these stories and letting them loose on the world and letting them work their magic on the people who are susceptible and who have the power to change things and design things. I think it's also important to remember that the early internet wasn't a utopia. There was plenty of utopian thinking. Mm. It had its problems. There were trolls. Stacey's service had one Nazi. It had sexual harassers. It had people that just enjoyed sowing chaos. But that's just humanity, right? And there's always going to be that aspect to it. I think the difference is a consequence of scale. Like, it's impossible to create a safe and equitable social platform when the goal is to have billions of users. It makes moderation impossible. It forces us to outsource moderation to contract workers who suffer deep trauma. And I think there's this holdover from the first wave of internet culture, this kind of utopian thinking that has influence this popular misconception that the internet is a community technology, but it's not necessarily a community technology anymore, because I think our social media platforms have figured out a way to hybridize community and commerce by selling communities to advertisers and to each other. So I think you know, having a clear-headed sense of where we are and how far we've come, and looking at some of the strategies that were in play early on and trying to implement them now. I think it's more helpful to think about what we can do rather than feel hopeless about what we've done.
I'm curious, what does cyberfeminism mean to you now? Where would you like to see it go?
I think the important thing is to create spaces that are safe for everybody. I don't think it's necessarily about making female corners of the internet or something. I think it's about building platforms, networks, communities that have a scale that makes them manageable, that makes people feel invested and like they're stakeholders in their own community. Because the way we have it now, I don't think online communities really are communities. I think they're products. And mm-hmm. I think we need to think about how to build real communities where everyone feels safe and taken care of, and everyone feels like they have a little bit of power, and that we're all coming up with what to do next together, rather than outsourcing that to some mega corporation that is just profiting from our infighting or something. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not so much about making places for women as it is making places for everybody, and then everybody benefits.
And for you personally, I mean, writing this book and researching it is clearly part of that, but you're also part of a collective, Deep Lab, which I think, you know, we could think of as a kind of cyberfeminist community. What does Deep Lab do?
Deep Lab is a loose affiliation of women who are interested in these kinds of topics. It's a lot of hardware hackers and artists and curators and writers and women who are working in the space of tech with a specific kind of artistic bent, I guess. But it's kind of just a mutual support group, frankly. I think I see a lot of that now. And I think that's sort of my favorite thing about the internet today. It's not so much what happens in the public sphere, but it's what happens in the group messages and the DMs and the Slack channels or whatever it is, the email lists of communities coming together and helping each other where they can. So I'm part of several different sort of Facebook groups of women who support each other where possible, you know, flag possible dangers for one another, put each other up for jobs, give each other mutual support. I think that kind of thing is what the internet is good for, can be really good for. It's not necessarily what's happening in the public sphere. It's about using the affordances of these technologies to help each other out.
Are there specific figures in the tech world today? Who are the women who are doing important work on the internet of tomorrow right now?
Great question. You know, it's funny, you spend years writing a history and everybody wants you to talk about the future. Honestly, I've been so lost in the history that I don't know that much about what's going forward, but I hope and I feel that there are women doing great work all around us that hopefully future historians, and maybe even more importantly, present day historians can celebrate and amplify.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, reading your book made me want to turn around and look for the next woman who's doing something terrific in tech and just make sure everybody else knows about her.
Yep. Yep. Well, that's your job. All right.
Yep. I'm on it. All right. Claire, thank you so much for talking today.
Of course. Thank you for caring about this stuff.
I thought the future would be cooler.
Bye.
Claire Evans is a science journalist and editor, a Vice contributor, and a singer for the pop group Yacht. Her book is called Broadband, The Untold Story of the Women Who Made the Internet. So what happened? The internet was supposed to be a place for everyone. Today, it's a breeding ground for trolls and conspiracy theorists. Coming up, how to take it back. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. The internet today is not quite the way its early pioneers imagined. For one thing, it's a lot more hostile. A recent Pew study found that 2/3 of Americans say they've seen someone being harassed or abused online, but considerably fewer have done anything about it. Pew also found a fair amount of disagreement over what even constitutes online abuse, which kind of sounds like a lot of us have just accepted harassment and trolling as a fact of life online. But do we have to? Well, remember Gamergate and the woman at the center of it? And warning, this gets a little disturbing.
I was out with friends in San Francisco, and my phone just started vibrating on the table constantly.
This is Zoe Quinn. She's a game designer.
I just saw a flood of notifications come in. People were talking about what a whore I was, and people were talking about putting dead animals in my mailbox, and it just kept speeding up. Like how you count times between thunderclaps to sort of tell where the storm is. All I could do is sort of stare numbly at my phone. Someone's like, your ex just posted like all this crazy stuff on this forum and it got deleted almost immediately, but I thought you should know. And I'm like, oh God, what? This was an abusive ex-boyfriend that I had just finally cut out of my life. He knew exactly how to engineer it. They were finding out the home addresses of my friends, compiling a dossier and saying, you know, let's burn her to the ground. Wikipedia editing my time of death to my next scheduled public appearance.
Oh God, what?
It basically went straight to the rape and death threats and continued unabated for weeks and months and now years.
First of all, can I just say, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I mean, I still think the internet is a net positive, and it's given me just about everything good I've had in my life, too. So if that's the cost, then that's the cost. But I would rather it not be for everybody else.
Did you ever consider quitting, finding a new career?
That was one thing a judge told me. When I eventually did get a restraining order against my ex, where he like looked at the stack of documents in front of him, said, I don't really understand what the internet is about, but if it's like this, you should just not be on it. And I'm like, Your Honor, there's no offline version of what I do. I'm an independent game developer. You're essentially asking me to give up my career. And he said, you're a smart kid. You'll find a new career. And that was it.
Well.
But it less than a consideration, though, like I couldn't work that much. Like, I would try. I would sit down and try to code or something, but it's not like it ever really stopped or slowed down. And every time that I did something that's part of my job, like going to a conference or showing a game, there would always be death threats associated with it, people talking about if they should bring a knife or a gun to one of my talks and stuff like that. So it makes it really hard to focus long enough to do anything. Because like as recent as late last year, people were going through my grandfather's obituary looking for names of family members that they hadn't already gotten to. And that's just, it's hard to do anything in that environment.
Yeah, I can imagine this experience might have really poisoned your feelings about your profession and about game design. So let's back up and talk about what you love about games and game design. What keeps you going in the work itself?
I've loved games pretty much from the first time I interacted with one. They were there for me when I was growing up and had kind of a rough childhood. It was like these whole other worlds that I could just lose myself in. And that was just like sincerely magic to me. Games as a whole really kind of captured my imagination just because of this interactive element where you're sort of dancing with this third party that you'll never meet probably. And you have to sort of account for their feelings and create this experience and sort of anticipate what they'll do and then put cool things in the way of what they'll do and give them choice and give them agency. Like this co-authorship with thousands of strangers is just really moving to me. It's like the ultimate show, don't tell. You know, it's a step beyond that. It's do, don't tell.
The games you design are, you know, a far cry from what I suppose a lot of people think about when you say just video games. You know, you don't do first-person shooters. These are not massive role-playing fantasy worlds. The games you design are much more intimate, personal.
Yeah.
For example, we should talk about your game Depression Quest, which I played recently, but let's walk through it a little bit.
Depression Quest is a short, I say semi-fictional game because it's like extrapolated from my experience and a lot of other people's experiences. And it was sort of an effort to show people that depression isn't just like a bad mood and depressed people aren't like stupid. It's just that you can't do something. You can see what you wish you could do, but you can't.
I have, and still do to some extent, struggle with depression. And so I was kind of worried as the game starts going that this was going to start triggering something for me. It was sobering. It was very familiar. I will say the game didn't make me feel horribly depressed, but it wasn't necessarily fun either.
Yeah, I have a strong belief that not all games have to be fun. fun is just another emotion that we can evoke in players, but it doesn't have to be the only emotion, you know?
Do you think the game content had anything at all to do with the vehemence with which you got targeted? I mean, it's a game that makes the player recognize feelings that they might prefer to avoid. And I wondered if the game itself made a certain cohort in the online gaming world feel threatened. You know, guys who are depressed, don't have much of a life. They're working dead-end jobs. Their closest relationships are with people in chat rooms.
Absolutely. And I mean, the frustrating thing is, like, that actually has a lot of things in common with me. But when you combine this sort of alternative way of making games with the fact that I don't look like what most people would think of when they think game developer, and what this sort of undercurrent of bitter, defensive nerds that yell at anybody that doesn't look like them being part of gaming and saying they can't be a real gamer and stuff like that. When you combine all of this, and my ex very carefully crafted the post to sort of put a bow on me like that, I was just like standing in the perfect intersection of all of this pent-up anger and frustration and rage and hate that had been already percolating in the games industry for a long time.
Yeah. Who are these people who've attacked and harassed you and so many other women?
There's a couple different kinds of people, right? There's the people that actually know you, like a bitter ex or a professional rival or something, or you're getting targeted by just some rando nightmare person. So there's like the individual one-off people that have very personal grudges. And then there's the people that don't know you at all, that see you as a symbol of something they dislike, or they're part of a community that is founded on organizing these sorts of campaigns against people. And there's many online that usually targeted on marginalized groups. And they will share targets and information about those targets. They will basically combine their efforts to dig up whatever they can on them and their family and their friends. Then you have the people who just kind of get swept up in that and don't verify or dig deeper. They just repeat it. So you've got the useful idiots in that corner. And then you have the lieutenants. You have these people that make a name off of pointing the mob where to go next. These people have like YouTube channels, crowdfunding things set up, and they monetize taking advantage of pre-existing fan bases of hating people and harassing people and stalking people. And they play to that.
So that's the side of it. And we've been talking about this as a social problem, but can't you also see this as a technological problem? Aren't there things Twitter or Facebook or Google or chat room hosts could be doing to protect people online?
I think a big part of it is designing around consent and streamlining reporting flows and making it easier for people to actually report things. Because it's like, say some rando online is like, yeah, I'm going to make this meme that has her boobies in it. I have to like go through and flag each individual thing and then try to hope that the back end of this platform has any sort of capability to create a case that's centered on the target and not the perpetrator, because they might see like little one-off things and they don't actually get the whole picture that this is all against one person. It's all the same thing. It's a mess to deal with, technologically speaking. People need to have the willingness to actually move on this and to draw the line. Tech is sort of looking to the law to tell them what to do, and the law is extremely painfully far behind. So tech really has to be our first line of defense, and they're just looking at an outdated system to make them actually do their job. And I wish it wasn't that way.
Zoe, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Zoe Quinn is the developer of Depression Quest. We put a link to it on our website at ttbook.org. Her memoir about her experience during Gamergate is called Crash Override. And more recently, she's been writing a comic series called Goddess Mode and collaborating on the game Solar Ash Kingdom. Roxane Gay is widely admired as one of the best feminist writers and critics of her generation. She's a woman with a history of tackling difficult subjects in essays and also in fiction. To give you just one example, Break All the Way Down, a story about a woman who drifts into an abusive relationship while mourning the death of her young son.
With that story, I was writing about grief. And what would you do to numb the pain if you lost your child in an unimaginable way? And so I thought you would want to feel a different kind of pain to cover up the emotional pain. And so she finds just a terrible guy. But it's consensual. It's consensual terrible. And so that's uncomfortable. That's an uncomfortable place to write and to be in. And I just loved just exploring what that would feel like.
In other words, Roxane Gay leans in to discomfort, and not just on the page. She's also an uncompromising presence on Twitter, where her bluntness has earned her a lot, and I mean a lot, of enemies. She's been attacked viciously for not only her writing, but her appearance, her weight, her sexuality, her gender, her race. And she engages. Roxane Gay told Raymond Tungekar, her attitude is the same online as it is on the page.
You know, I write to that place where I'm horrified and uncomfortable, and where I have to look away, and where I know the reader is going to have to look away. I just like to transgress boundaries in ways that I think are creatively productive. And so I do write to that place of just absolute discomfort.
Why do you push yourself like that? I mean, why do you do that kind of emotional labor? Is there a deeper, like, true, a universal truth that you're trying to get at?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it, it doesn't feel like emotional labor. It's certainly challenging to go there, but it's fun.
Really?
And I don't mean that in a sociopathic way. It's just, as a writer, you're always looking to challenge yourself and to challenge your comfort zones. And so for me, there's a lot of creative joy to be found in going to these dark places. Yeah, it's hard to put it into words, but there is a lot of creative joy, while at the same time recognizing that, you know, these are dark stories and painful themes that I'm looking at.
So, you know, the book is titled Difficult Women. How would you define difficult women?
In many ways, just like with Bad Feminist, the title is a bit tongue-in-cheek, and it's challenging this idea that women are difficult when we have opinions. And I think a difficult woman can be a lot of different things, but generally a difficult woman is a woman who takes up space and who uses her voice and demands to be heard and seen.
Do you approach writing for the internet any differently than you do writing for a print audience?
No, I don't. I don't, because I don't ever want to compromise how I say something or why I say something.
But yeah, at the same time, I would imagine that when writing for the internet, you're probably more likely to hear from your audience.
Well, you are more likely to hear from your audience, but I can't allow that to shape how I write. And so I don't.
I guess what I'm amazed by is you are an incredibly prolific writer. But in addition to that, you're also like a really prolific tweeter. And I would think that as someone who writes frequently about sexuality and race and gender, I would think that you would get a lot of pushback from some groups or people. But what I find really inspiring and kind of remarkable is that you do take time and you do engage with the people who try to criticize or troll you.
Yeah, I do. And I don't do it for any noble reason. I do it because you got to bring dirt to the light. And these people are horrible. And not because they disagree with me. I'm talking about the people who harass and troll me and just generally seek to make my life more miserable. You know, I think it's important that people realize the scope and breadth of what women, and particularly women of color, deal with on the internet.
And just to put things in perspective, I mean, how much of this kind of trolling would you face on a weekly basis?
It really depends on the week. It really does. And it depends on sort of whether I'm in the news or not. I made news because I pulled a book from a publisher, and that was quite horrific that week. So it just depends on what's going on.
So I guess what I find fascinating is you're someone who's been quite open about struggling with shyness and finding your own voice. And so I would think that someone who's shy wouldn't want to engage with their trolls in such a public platform.
Oh, it's very easy to engage on the internet. That's why I'm on Twitter, because on Twitter, I have the, not courage necessarily, but I'm outgoing enough online to be able to say what I want when I want to say it. What I wish I could do is take that energy into my day-to-day life.
What is it about Twitter that provides you that freedom or that space to kind of be more open than you normally would?
I think just the safety of the screen. And, You know, I can be in my own space at home most of the time or on my phone. And, you know, like it's easier to just think quickly and to feel witty and to feel smart, like in that environment where you're not like directly facing someone. And I think that's the exact same reason why people troll online.
Do you have a personal philosophy when it comes to, you know, dealing with Twitter trolls?
Yeah, my personal philosophy is that nothing good is coming of engaging with them. That engaging with them is, again, it's just bringing their behaviors to the light and letting people know, this is not okay. This is not how we talk to or treat each other. But I keep it in its proper perspective. And I also don't really encourage anyone to engage with my trolls because they're just trolling. I mean, 9 times out of 10, they don't even believe the things that they're saying. They just are bored and lonely and clearly suffering in some form or fashion.
That's remarkable. Even when talking about your trolls, you still speak of them with a sense of empathy and like this attempt to understand them and their motivations.
I mean, I have to believe that someone who would create a Twitter account just to harass me about my looks on a random Thursday is someone who is desperately sad in their own life. I have to believe that, or they're just pathetic. And that's sad. Like, I have at least a life. So It's very easy to have empathy for people like that.
And if you are not already, you can follow writer Roxane Gay on Twitter, @rgay. She also wrote the essay collection Bad Feminist and has a collection of short stories called Difficult Women. Raymond Dangarkar talked with her. It's tempting to blame the big social media platforms and apps for enabling the kind of trolling we've been talking about. But, you know, it's more complicated than an evil plan to build a toxic internet on a whiteboard somewhere, right? I mean, in theory, the engineers who build this stuff want us to love it, not be tortured by it. They want to believe their work makes the world better. So where do they go wrong? Well, maybe in the design process itself. See, when programmers and engineers are building a new platform or service, they create what they call use cases, stories, basically, about what an average user might do with a new social media app. Sarah Wachter-Betcher says what they should be creating are misuse cases.
These are the use cases that aren't the intended uses, but these are the use cases when something goes wrong, when somebody's in a crisis moment, or when the unexpected happens. Journalist Olivia Solon, she had posted on Instagram a screenshot of an email she received that was full of rape threats. And she posted it on Instagram because she wanted her friends and her followers to know that this is the kind of stuff that women get when they dare to report on technology. So she posted that on Instagram. Lots of people commented on it because it was a really awful thing that she'd received. Well, Facebook, because it owns Instagram and wants more Facebook users to also use Instagram, had taken that screenshot and put it into an advertisement for Instagram and then shown that to her friends. So if you were her friend and you didn't yet use Instagram, they would show you this ad for Instagram with a rape threat in it.
When we come back, a concrete proposal for how to fix social media and a novel approach to trolls. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. When you poll Americans about online harassment, more than half of us blame the platform. Apparently, we think Facebook and Twitter need to clean up their acts. But how? Banning bad actors would be a great start. But what about the more subtle ways that online spaces can feel cruel or hostile? Sarah Wachter-Betcher talks to designers and engineers in the tech world about the problem of unintentional misuse, software that harms because the designers didn't imagine all the ways it might be used. She told Shannon Henry Kleiber that while trolls are horrible, it might be bias that actually causes social media spaces to become toxic to their users.
I think that you can really see bias at play in so many different places in the digital tools that you use every day. So for example, you can definitely see it in search engines. You can see it in the way where if you search for, I don't know, a Google image search for a CEO, you are going to get pretty much images of white men. And if you do a Google search for anything related to, for example, black girls, you will get some exceptionally racist results. There's pictures of black women and girls that are always sexualized versus the kinds of search results you get if you search for white girls or white women or just women or girls in general. You can see bias in pretty much any place online if that's something that you want to go look for. And I think that some of the ways that that plays out are some of them are small. Some of them are really everyday where it's things like you go to fill out a form and it has drop-down menus where you can fill out what your gender is or you could fill out what your title is and none of those options actually fit you. Or it can happen in really big ways where we're starting to see things like algorithms and image recognition, things that are driven by AI that have fundamental biases built into them that can do things like make it more difficult for, let's say, people who live in certain zip codes and tend to be of a certain race to get access to housing or to financial services. So these kinds of problems play out over time. And what has happened is that you have a tech industry that's sort of been underinvested in understanding these kinds of problems or understanding unintended consequences of its design decisions for so long that the problems have now gotten really big and we're at a pretty messy state in the industry.
How can we change that?
Well, I think one of the things we really need to do is stop valorizing some of the tech that's been created before and start looking at it a little more critically so that we can develop alternate futures for technology. You know, we spent years and years and years kind of looking at Facebook as this bright shining star because it's like, oh, this massively powerful platform. People around the world use it. Almost everybody, it seems like, at one point had a Facebook account. And wow, Mark Zuckerberg came up with this from his dorm room. That's amazing. We didn't spend a lot of time looking very critically at that story. Did you know when he started Facebook, it was called FaceMash, and the entire goal of that product was to rank the attractiveness of women students at Harvard without their consent or permission?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when he was first creating it, he even said he wanted to compare students to farm animals because he thought so many of them looked horrendous. That is the product vision of Facebook. Now, obviously, it's evolved a lot. I'm not saying that that's what he continued building. But what I do want to say is that we have to look at, okay, that is where the product came from. That's the origin story.
Let's talk about some other examples. I know there was a design flaw in Apple's voice assistant Siri that basically when someone asks Siri for help after they've been sexually assaulted, it responds with confusion or something unhelpful or even something really inappropriate. How did that happen?
If you were asking Siri for help during different kinds of crises, anything that was related to things like sexual assault or domestic violence, Siri really would respond with no idea of what to do because Siri didn't understand the entire nature of the query, right? And so there's a couple things at play there. One, it means that when they were thinking of use cases for Siri, so how are users going to interact with this voice assistant, they weren't thinking about negative situations or emergency situations or crisis situations. So I think one of the problems there is that we need to be thinking both about sort of the intended use cases and also unintended use cases. Unintended use cases mean sort of those stress or crisis moments, but also things like, are people using this product to hurt someone or harm someone? How could this be used in a way that is violent or unethical? So on the one hand, there was this huge gap in the things that Siri was trained to be able to do. But there's people who would say, well, yeah, but Siri's never going to understand everything you say. And I agree, absolutely. What I think you also have to think about is what happens when Siri doesn't know what to do? And at the time, when Siri didn't know what to do, one of the most common responses would be to crack a joke. But that's not very funny if you're asking for help because you've been sexually assaulted. That's not humorous anymore. And I think what we find in the tech industry is that that comes from a design culture that's very focused on things like delight. So we want to make this a delightful and engaging experience for users. And you're imagining people who, you know, ask Siri something and she says something funny back and they can crack up over it. And that sounds fun. And then nobody thinks about, well, wait a second, what are the times when delight is not going to happen, when delight is not an appropriate response?
Does this go back to the people creating this algorithm need to be diverse, need to maybe be people who might have had these situations to even think of such things?
You certainly find that a huge, huge percentage of the teams that are developing anything related to speech recognition, text recognition, image recognition tend to be predominantly male, very engineering oriented, and not particularly diverse. So one of the things that you really miss, in addition to missing out on, for example, the perspective of women or missing out on the perspective of people of color, you also are often not getting the perspective of people who understand the social and cultural implications of what they're doing.
Another example, which I think is in this vein, is about your friend Eric Meyer. Can you tell me about that?
Eric Meyer is somebody I've known for a long time. He was an early, you know, web developer. He also maintained a personal blog for a very long time. So he's very used to telling the world about things that are happening to him. Then one day, Eric's daughter was diagnosed with an aggressive brain cancer. And he documented every aspect of her illness in this blog. And so, you know, thousands and thousands of people were sort of following along with him and his story. And then ultimately, she ended up dying on her 6th birthday. And it was this tragic, awful, terrible year for him. And he gets to the end of that year, it's December, and he logs onto Facebook, it's Christmas Eve, and he's expecting, you know, the well wishes of friends and family and kind of seeing what people are up to. And instead, he's confronted by this picture of his daughter. And right around it, it says, "Eric, here's what your year looked like." And it's an advertisement for a feature called Year in Review, which was brand new at the time. And what Year in Review would do, and Facebook has since started doing a lot more of this, this was the first time they did it, is it'll take all of your sort of highlights of the year and repackage them up for you, right? So it'll say, okay, what's the most popular content you posted all year? Let's package it up in an album, show it to you, and then try to get you to share it with your friends. The idea being that that kind of content is popular, so people will look at it, people engage with it, leave comments on it, etc. And every time you engage with that, that's more advertising revenue for them. What they did is they took the most popular photo he had posted all year. That photo, of course, was the photo of his daughter that he posted right after she died.
That's so sad.
Ugh. And they, you know, the thing that really got me about it is that they didn't just take that photo and insert it into his year in review, but they also surrounded it by these illustrations that Facebook designers had created of people like dancing at a party and balloons and streamers. It was super celebratory. And nobody had stopped and thought, huh, what if the most popular content that they posted this year wasn't the most positive? This is not somebody water skiing in Hawaii on their honeymoon. This is the worst day of his life that they've decided to wrap up in balloons and streamers and be like, hey, don't you want to see this again?
Oh, that's heartbreaking. Did Facebook fix it?
Well, it depends how you define fix it. So this story blew up. He wrote this on his blog. It blew up. It ends up on Slate, and it ends up in these newspapers around the world. And he gets a phone call from the product manager at Facebook, who is responsible for this feature, who apologized to him. But what you'll find is that Facebook, quote unquote, fixed it in the sense that the next year when they did Year in Review, they designed it a little differently to not take your photo and put it right on the cover. You had to kind of opt into being in the Year in Review album before it made that for you, right? However, they didn't really fix it in the sense of there was no sort of larger principles that they seemed to pull from that, because you see that they keep doing similar things over and over again.
It really is about feelings. I mean, people are behind the scenes making decisions with their own values and ethics that come through the technology.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when you said it's about feelings, yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think we've seen over and over again is that the tech industry has spent a long time really hiring for technical skills alone. But we're not just designing technology. We are fundamentally shaping people's interactions with each other, their relationship with things like their employment and their money. These are really big and intimate things that people have a huge emotional connection to. We need to invest in understanding those things and understanding the potential impact of our work and having experts involved who know about that at a really deep level. And I think that that is just as valuable as somebody who can program.
Sarah Wachter-Betcher is a product and content strategy consultant and the author of Technically Wrong: Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. Plus, she has a podcast about work, friendship, and feminism called Strong Feelings. And she was talking with Shannon Henry Kleiber. So there are long-term solutions to the problems we have online, but is there a way we might jumpstart things, get them moving in a positive direction, turning trolls into fuel for growth and change? Emily Temple Wood has been an avid Wikipedia editor since she was pretty young, and early on she noticed that Wikipedia has a twofold gender bias problem. Women make up a minority of the active editors on the site. They're also in the minority as subjects of articles. So Emily began recruiting more women editors to write more Wikipedia articles about more women. And in return, she got rape and death threats. Instead of retreating, she came up with an ingenious way to use the platform itself for revenge. She decided that every time she got another hate-filled, misogynistic message from a troll, she'd write a new Wikipedia bio of a female scientist. In 2016, she was named Wikipedian of the Year. She currently juggles her editing with a full slate of coursework in med school, but Charles Monroe Kane got hold of her between lectures.
So every time you get some troll online being a jerk, you directly keep track of that somewhere in your house or apartment and say, okay, I now owe the world a bio of a scientist on Wikipedia?
Yeah, I currently owe the world about 150 biographies.
Oh no, there's a backlog.
Well, there's a backlog because, you know, medical school.
Sure, you're busy.
I wrote one this morning, so I'm taking it down one by one.
Tell me about one of them.
Sure. So one of my favorites, her name was Tilly Edinger. And she's since popped up in a couple of other places on the internet, which makes me extraordinarily happy because more people need to know about this lady.
Okay.
She invented a field called neuropaleontology. So in the 1800s in Germany, she discovered that when you looked at fossils of skulls, you could inject plaster or other material into them and make a cast of what the animal's brain looked like. And you could get so much information out of this. Kind of a crazy genius.
I will say, this is probably the most creative and empowering response I have ever heard to violence like this on the internet. Is that the response you get from most people, or some people like, oh God, you're wasting your time?
I would say 99% of it is positive. Just like what you said, that people think it's creative and it's funny and it's empowering. I do get the occasional hate mail that says something to the effect of like, you're a stupid bitch and you are wasting your time writing about these dumb bitches who didn't do anything important. Women scientists aren't real. I literally got an email that just said women scientists aren't real.
Wow.
And I'm literally sitting in a lab that is staffed by all women except for, you know, our two token guys, run by a woman. And I'm just like, come on, come on.
I want to talk about you, but I do want to take a step because you have some insight into these guys. Like, what the hell?
I think it's part of why they do this is that they're threatened. You know, they feel like I'm public property because I'm a woman existing in a public space. And there's the anonymity of the internet. I'm a target because my name is known. There's pictures of me, God forbid. And there's a lot of easy things for guys to pick up on. I don't read comments anymore for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. But I did at first, and it was horrifying. It was all about my appearance. My boobs are too big. They're too small. My hair's the wrong color. It's greasy. My face is the wrong shape. Like, all this stuff, and they just feel the need to lash out, and that's the only way they know how.
But Emily, you and I know that this could be dangerous. It isn't just a hurt feeling. I mean,
I get death threats all the time. I've been getting death threats since I was 13 years old. And part of me just doesn't care anymore. But, you know, the first time I got a threat that was like, I'm going to murder your family and rape their dead bodies while I make you watch. I was 13. That freaked me out. I didn't know what to do. And I let it get to me. It was hard.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it would get to you because it's messed up.
It's so messed up.
But the other thing is that, you know, empowerment is a muscle. I was told that once. And it sounds like you've been flexing and flexing and flexing that muscle. And you're quite the empowered woman. But it always seems like it's at a price. Is this whole thing worth it?
100%. Every day, I've made some of my best friends through this work all over the world. I've connected with women, I've heard their stories, and I've gotten to know these women from history in such a deep, substantial way. I've gotten to dig into their papers and their writings and the details of their stories, their struggles and their triumphs. And every day that inspires me more and more. You know, reading about the first women to go to medical school makes me really grateful for the place that I'm in right now. It makes me want to study that much harder. And it's a joy for me to share these stories with the world. Every time someone reads it, that makes my heart grow.
That was Emily Temple Wood talking with Charles Monroe Kane. She's a third-year medical student at Midwestern University in Chicago. We reached her between classes in her car. By the way, Emily's backlog has shrunk a bit since this first aired, but there are always more brilliant women in need of profiling. You can pick out a female scientist and contribute a bio over at Emily's Wiki Project for Women Scientists. You'll find a link on our website at ttbook.org. And that's it for this hour. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Mark Rickers produced this hour, with help from Angelo Bautista, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Charles Monroe Kane. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks for listening.